So I want to begin, I guess, period now before Pesach, or 30 days before Pesach, 30 days before the Yantiv. We teach about Yantiv, especially about Pesach, a lot of rules about Pesach. So I wanted to start teaching a number of Tshuvot, and I just quoted a few here. I might change this as we go through the weeks. But I wanted to go through a number of Tshuvot that Rav Moshe Feinstein deals with for Pesach, and of course, as you kind of expected, Rav Moshe has a lot to say about Pesach. So let's go through it. The first topic I want to deal with is actually preemptive to Pesach, with actually the Tanit Bechorot, the fast for the firstborns. I actually have to be a firstborn also, so this is relevant to me. But I think it's just interesting and informative, regardless, as Rav Moshe explains right away. Let's just start right away, and you'll see the point as we go through it. So he's asked the following shaila in 1956 with regard to B'davar siyum limud sefer mikra im nechshav sudat mitzvah. Can you make a siyum on Tanakh? Does that count towards making a siyum for the purpose of, making it a sudat mitzvah, a festive meal, such that you no longer have to fast on that given day?
Or Tanakh, or any part of Tanakh?
Well, the question seems to be on Tanakh, though. Or no, well, actually, the question here seems to be a safer one book of Tanakh.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, what a book of Tanakh is, it's not clear, but we'll see in a second when Moshe analyzes.
I used to learn with guys years ago when I was in my 20s, back then. We used to learn every Shabbos, and when we finished each, we learned Chumash and Rashi. When we finished Brachos, we made a siyum,
right?
Or, whatever. We didn't do a hajjah or anything.
Right.
We went out and had a nice dinner together when we finished.
So. Right. Well, I think it's interesting about this question is that I think nowadays, I mean, I can't speak for 20 years ago, but definitely nowadays, I think in the modern Orthodox world, the answer to this should be like fairly obvious. Like, of course, why not? It's not like just as much learning Torah as anything else. If anything, it's like the primary Torah, you know? Right. And yet, I think if you're more aware of like the yeshiva bent, Tanakh is just not popular. It's not just not popular; it's almost not shunned. That might be a little too strong, but it's very close to it. It's deprioritized in a very strong way. I mean, I'll just tell you my own experience. Like, I rediscovered Tanakh almost like in yeshiva or post yeshiva, just because like I didn't learn Chumash at all. Like in high school and middle school, like we barely learned Tanakh. That was just we just learned Gemara. That's the main, the Ikar. I mean, the Gemara even says that if you can learn Talmud, that's, it covers also Tanakh. And so I think that the larger movement, especially in the Yeshiva world, tends to really focus a lot on Talmud, a lot on Gemara, a lot of Mishnayot, and a lot less on Tanakh. So much so that Rav Moshe, that this question is not really out of left field. It really makes a lot of sense. This non-observant Jew, less observant Jew, like make a Shema on Tanakh? Because he can't make a siyum during Gemara. Obviously, I'm exaggerating, putting words in the question here, but I do think that's kind of the attitude people have. Of course, that's not the attitude we should have. Of course, I really do believe in Tanakh. I think Tanakh is great. I've taught a lot of Tanakh classes. I hope to keep teaching a lot of Tanakh classes here at Lincoln Square. I think it should be obvious that it should have a lot of value. And yet, nonetheless, despite the fact that it has a lot of value, it's not a very traditional sense of what a siyum is. And so, this is a question your emotion is being asked. And I guess we'll see how Rav Moshe deals with this question. Any other comments so far before we address? Okay, so he asked the following question. This is Rosh Chodesh Shvat Tavshin Tedvav, about January of 1956 or so. And he asked the question, he's responding to Yisachar Goldberg. I'm not sure what it said. Moshe Yisachar Goldberg, someone. V'davar im yesh lachshiv sudat mitzvah liftor habachorim mitanit erev Pesach v'lachol basar mirosh chodesh av ad tanit. The question is as follows. Can I use a siyum in Tanakh, a portion of Tanakh that I've learned with a group of people in Be'iyun? So not just Be'kiyut, but the question is being asked specifically, I'm learning it in depth. I've like really covered this book or, this particular section of Tanakh well. And I want to use this siyum to be able to obviate the need to fast on the Tanit Bechorot, the fast for the firstborn before Pesach, or alternatively, to be able to obviate the need to the restriction against eating meat during the 9 days, right? So can I make a siyum on Tanakh during the 9 days so that I can eat meat, right? Yeah.
Do you need a minion for a siyum?
Do you need a minion? For the Kaddish, you would, not for
right,
the not for the submit.
But in terms of if you learned on your own, in terms of the for Pesach, is that good enough?
As far as I know, no. As far as I know, you wouldn't need it. It is better, but you don't need it.
Yourself. You can't make a scene just for yourself, right?
I actually think you might be able to make a scene for yourself. Yeah, I mean, it's like a mitzvah, certainly, to like have other people join. But I think you can make a suit of mitzvah to yourself. You know, you're living on an island or whatever it is. Have what to celebrate. So Rav Moshe has a really interesting analysis here, because he begins this question, right? And he says as follows. How does he deal with this question? He says, so first I want to point out that while he's addressing the question, it's hard to know, is this the questioner's way of wording the question, or is this Rav Moshe's addendum to the question? But as he mentions, the question says as follows, that they're learning Mikra B'iyun, they're learning Tanakh in depth, right? Not just broadly, but really they're going into like each particular text, close readings. And the teacher is specifically in this instance teaching them the teachings of Chazal, right? So they're quoting Midrashei Chazal, right? Midrash Chazal doesn't mean they're learning Midrash necessarily, but they're learning, you know, some type of pirush of well-accepted commentaries. And we'll see actually Rav Moshe comes back to this later on, and it's actually an interesting question to think about. How does Rav Moshe view, you know, like modern study of Tanakh? And we'll talk about it maybe some other time, but Rav Moshe has some very well-known tshuvot where he was not such a favor of like modern study of Tanakh in the same way. And he clearly was limiting what he believed the value of Tanakh to more traditional methods of learning Tanakh. So it's an interesting thing to think about already as we read through this tshuva, what type of Tanakh in Rav Moshe's mind is, you know, a valid form of learning. But either way, that's the question asked. So he says the following, Shadat Ktvot Torato. So the person who asked the question, he wanted to suggest the following. Shigam zeh nechshav su ha-mitzvah kishisiyum esachet, ugeha dechazinat sheosim studa legamar shal Torah b'kriyat ha-Torah b'simcha Torah. So the questioner had proposed the following. The questioner also thought that this was a valuable way of making a siyum. You can make a siyum and, you know, obviate the need to fast on time behorot or be able to eat meat during 9 days. Based on the model, what model should you use to prove that siyum Tanakh counts as a siyum, as a valid simcha, valid form of happiness? So the questioner said, maybe simcha Torah, right? All of Klal Yisrael, every single year, we finish the Torah and we make a big feast. We make, you know, we're very happy. You know, people drink, people get happy, you're merry. So maybe that is a model. And he quotes that, quotes from the Torah and the Rama, that quote this the minhag that we have to finish the Torah on Simchas Torah. There's even like a verse that's quoted in regard to making a feast with regard to fitting to the Torah. So imkein mashma d'lav davka Torah shabapel afiyu Torah shabichtav. And therefore, the model of Simchat Torah might be a proof to the fact that you can make a siyum and be happy and have a festive meal, even with regard to finishing Torah shabichtav, and not only when you finish Torah shabapel. Right. Even Torah Shabichtav might have a festive meal. Rav Moshe adds, though, Hinei, Av Shevada in Zerai Brura, the Kriyat Torah Shikviut L'chol Yisrael Efshar Shani. He says, this proof on its own is not necessarily the best proof, simply because when it comes to Kriyat Torah of Simcha Torah, right, when we finish, that's a very different type of Simcha. That's, you know, a public, communal happiness due to a communal obligation of finishing the Torah that's, you know, incumbent upon every single person. It's a very different type of happiness than like an individual or a group of people who finished the book of Tanakh, that, you know, they chose to pick this book of Tanakh not under like an organized schedule. It's just them and no one else is, you know, joining in their particular schedule. So that might be a little different from the model of Simchat Torah. So Rav Moshe wants to actually avoid the model of Simchat Torah, and in fact wants to argue actually something much broader when it comes to a siyum in general. I think it's actually a really interesting principle he wants to suggest. Says the emet. He thinks it's true, you can make a siyum atzalach. Why is it true? You can make a siyum even for learning, you know, in depth a Torah, a book of Tanakh. He says as follows. Anytime you have a mitzvah that you have, it's been a journey to complete that mitzvah, and you have now completed that mitzvah, then you can make a siyum on that mitzvah. And what's the proof to this? What's the case he wants to bring? Is the case the Rashbam quotes in Bava Batra. K'di'ita b'Rashbam b'Bava Batra daf kuf chaf alef, b'tamra b'Rav Yosef d'yontav shal chamisha asar b'av, m'shim sheposkim bo m'lechrot etzim l'marcha. Because the Gemara in Bava Batra says as follows. The Gemara says that on the 15th of Av, the certain family of Kohanim would make a day of Yontif. They would make a whole festive meal on a particular day, on the 15th day of Av, what we think of as Tu B'Av nowadays. And this is separate from the story of the girls dancing. This is a different reason because, and the Rashbam explains what would happen. So we want to talk about the bottom of that, of the first page. I actually quoted that Rashbam here. Misam Vat Ted Vav Ba'av. So Rashbam quotes as follows. Hayu Kortim Etzim Masorach HaMarachal Achol Shana. You know, during the summer months, what they would do is they would cut the wood necessary for the altar, for the Mizbeach. You know, they would cut a lot of wood for it. And so they figured out the best time, when is the best time of year to cut all this wood. So they figured the best time of year to cut the wood was in the summer months. Because in the summer in Israel, it doesn't rain. And so the wood would be the driest. Like the trees would be very dry, there'd be less moisture. And so they figured that if you cut all the wood until Tu B'Av, that would be the end point at which point the sun would start to weaken. Tashash kocha chama. I guess it's kind of like the summer equinox of sorts. The sun would no longer be, well, not really. Summer equinox would be in June, but it's like the point in time in the year where the sun is no longer as powerful, and therefore the wood is not going to be as dry. And so they would try to complete cutting all the wood by Tu B'Av, such that like all the wood for the year would be the driest possible and be able to burn the cleanest. And so that's what the Midrash, and that's what the Rashbam quotes, that they would finish cutting all this wood by Tu B'Av, and he skipped the last line. He says, "V'oto yom shepasko yusmechim." On that particular day, on Tu B'Av, they'd be very happy. They finished this big mitzvah of preparing the wood for the altar, and they would v'fish v'oto yom ayom shlim mitzvah gedola kazot, because they finished this large mitzvah. And so, going back to Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe wants to make the following argument. He says, we see that they made this big feast. They were very happy. They made a big day of Yontif, this like festive day, because they finished this mitzvah. And he says, so too, anytime we finish a mitzvah, it also should be like a festive meal. It should be something very happy about it. And he says, V'af shelo matzinu chiyuv mitzvah, this is the middle of the third paragraph, even though when it comes to the particular instance of them cutting the wood, we don't find some type of formal obligation on our part to make a festive meal. There's no like mitzvah to have like a student mitzvah on Tu B'Av. And it's not entirely clear that they had a festive meal. For all we know, all they did, they just had a happy day. It was just a day they didn't fast on. But it's not clear they actually had a meal. Nonetheless, humishum de lo yu anashim yuchadim she masu kol mitzvah, ela zemat ve zemat ad shegamru vehavi agmar lechol yisrael bekolel velo lechol achad b'prat. He makes the following distinction. He says, when it comes to everyone cutting the wood on for Tu B'Av, why in that situation they had a happy day, but they didn't necessarily have a festive meal? And that's the important criteria here. Because we don't just want a happy day for a seal. We want specifically a festive meal, because the festive meal, right, partaking in that festive meal, that's what's going to allow you to eat meat, right, because you're eating meat in the festive meal during the 9 days, and that's what's going to allow, if you are a Bechor, a firstborn, to eat on Erev Pesach, because you're partaking in this festive meal. So Rav Moshe has to prove that not only are you happy, you know, you have a joyous occasion because you did finish this mitzvah, but you also have a festive meal. And there's no proof that we know of that on Tu B'Av, they would have a festive meal. So Rav Moshe makes, and as he often does, there's no proof of it, but Rav Moshe makes, you know, a sort of analytical distinction. He says that when it comes to the situation of Tu B'Av, how would they cut the wood? So it wouldn't be one person who cut all the wood. That would be just too much. Instead, there were a bunch of people, and each person would cut a little bit of wood. And so in effect, what you have is not one person who completed the full mitzvah, but you have a bunch of people who together, the culmination of all their efforts, completed a mitzvah. And he says, in that situation, that's lo chiyuv b'suda. That's not going to obligate you in a festive meal. It's going to obligate you maybe in a yontov be'alma, some type of joyous occasion, but it's not necessarily a festive meal. For a festive meal, you're going to require that each individual completed the mitzvah on their own in its entirety. And therefore, therefore you can preserve this model, even though we have no proof that they ate a festive meal, because they're an exception, they didn't do the mitzvah on their own, but if you yourself you know, finished the book of Tanakh and you participated and learned through the whole book of Tanakh, then you can have a student mitzvah because you yourself, you know, completed this task, this mitzvah from start to finish. That's Rav Moshe's main argument here. And he says, he keeps going, he says, Aval kolpanim, yesh lo muzeh, sheyesh lasot simcha legmar kol mitzvah. And therefore you can learn that anytime you actually finish the full mitzvah, you can make a student mitzvah. V'lchein ba'anashim miyuchadim. And therefore, special people, right, unique people, shosim mitzvah meshech zman, right? And Moshe uses this very classic, or Moshe using this, you know, flowery language to praise people to do a mitzvah. So anytime you've done a mitzvah for a long time to complete it, yesh lahen lasot suda l'simchatan, they should make a festive meal to celebrate their happiness. Ki simcha cheresh mu lasot et hayom liyontov lo shayach b'yichidim. When it comes to making a simcha like yontov, that's not relevant for individuals. About suda hamatzinu she'osin yichidim ligmar mitzvatan. So you can't really have like a day, like a yontov day, where you know you're forbidden from halacha or you can't fast, you know, just because you did a mitzvah. But there is a value in having a festive meal that Rav Moshe believes you do have, and therefore, when it comes to a siyum masechta, when it comes to finishing a tractate of Gemara, the kmochein ugmar mitzvah acheret, and so to any other mitzvah that you've completed, shechazin l'sheish lasa mitzvah bigmar kol mitzvah, you can, anytime you have some type of happiness for having completed a task, you should make a student mitzvah, and therefore you can as well have a student mitzvah when it comes to finish of Tanakh. And he keeps going on this. Ve'od efshar shu ashdochi b'studah bar mitzvah k'sitat etzim nikomakom lasu sudah hayta sudah mitzvah. It is possible as well. Another argument you can make to defend this proof from the cutting of the wood is that it could be that, you know, we have no proof that they actually did this, but it could be that there's no obligation, formal obligation for them, you know, in their time to make a sudah mitzvah, but there still is a value in doing so. So it could be, and their motion doesn't fully expound on this, but it could be that if you finish the book of Tanakh, you know, you don't have an obligation to make a siyum, but it's still valuable to do so. And Rav Moshe doesn't say this here, actually. But, you know, if you're talking about in terms of, like, the value in terms of why make a siyum, like, what's the importance of a siyum, you could list a few different you know, rationales for why siyum are valuable. You could talk about the fact that, you know, celebrating Torah itself is always valuable, right? So anytime you celebrate a mitzvah, you know, just a very celebration of a mitzvah of Torah learning, it's valuable, and this is just a good place to stop. It could be also, you know, sometimes it's good to finish things. And I think it's valuable sometimes to, you know, it's always good to learn different things. And, you know, we're never going to finish all the tshuvas of Rav Moshe. There's just thousands of them. But, you know, sometimes when it comes to learning, it does give you a certain sense of accomplishment when you really finish something, you know, finish a mitzvah, finish a task. And I think that there's certainly value in a siyum, so to speak, as a capstone to having finished this mitzvah. And the third thing I'd say, for it comes to a siyum, and I think this is, he doesn't mention this, but I think this is really integral to a siyum, and this goes back to Alan's question, which is that I think part of the idea of a siyum is it's often meant to bring along other people. That, you know, Rav Moshe's particular example, he's talking about this, like, group of people who've been learning, you know, a book of Tanakh together. They should make a siyum on their own. Great, very nice, beautiful, excellent. But there's also a value in siyum in kind of inviting other people who didn't partake in that particular mitzvah. Right? Just because you didn't learn this book of Tanakh, or this tractate of Gemara, whatever it is, doesn't mean that you can't participate in this simcha. And, you know, collectively we celebrate, you know, this accomplishment together. We're all taking part of it. And yes, I didn't learn this particular, you know, limud. I didn't learn this, you know, this information with you. But nonetheless, like, I'm joyous for you, and I'm celebrating Torah with you, you know, alongside you. And I think that communal aspect is a really integral part of a siyum, which might explain also why, like, any student mitzvah, any type of mitzvah that you complete, there's a value in, you know, having the student mitzvah and inviting everyone along.
He doesn't bring any riyas from, like, bris milah or pidyon haben or weddings or anything?
So those, the thing is that none of those have, like those wouldn't be good models, because those are just, like, separate mitzvah that you have a meal accompanying it. There's no like completion. It wouldn't necessarily be a proof to it.
Well, there's a completion of that mitzvah once they do the milah, and then you celebrate it, right? I mean, I would have thought that might have been something you could have brought.
But it's not clear that that's more of like a way of celebrating a meal. It's not so much that's it's not clear that would be a proof to like a separate occasion.
Yeah, he's talking about the language you talked about was broader. So when you have a happy occasion or
when they have occasion, a mitzvah, completion of a mitzvah,
celebrate.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think it's not. I mean, once you already have the principle, you can say this might be a model for it. Yeah. But I don't think you could have necessarily extracted that on its own. I think that's kind of why Moshe avoids using those as, you know, evidence. But it is an interesting point, and it's worth noting that, you know, even though the question here was talking about Tanakh, of course, he's actually his answer actually is very broad. In theory, you can make a siyum on anything. You know, if you did some type of mitzvah, you're working for Habitat for Humanity, and you were building homes. So if you finished building a home for someone, in theory, as like Chesed, in theory, right then you can make a siyum, right, on that type of mitzvah, right? It's really expansive to anything that there's like kind of a completion. So like, you know, Bikur Cholim, I guess if the person recovers, you can make a, you know, siyum for that, but it's not really, you know, some mitzvah it might not be so easy to come up with where you make a siyum. But for other mitzvah, like Chesed mitzvah, you know, there are a lot of things you can think of where there is a form of completion that happens at the end of the year or whatever it is, you know, a bat mitzvah project, you know, or, you know, bar mitzvah project, any type of like Chesed project that you accomplish, like all of those would also be just as, you know, worthwhile and valid as a siyum in Tanakh. All of which is to say that you didn't have to go as far as Rav Moshe. You could have differentiated between, you know, learning Torah and like other mitzvot. But Rav Moshe is taking a much broader approach of all mitzvot should have a seal. And he quotes at the end, he quotes some proofs to this. And he says at the end, I'm going to skim a little bit, and he says, in the last paragraph, Imkein vaday yesh lilmon mizeh, shegam limud mikra b'chaburash, nimshach eiz ezman, shelo gar mikol mitzvah, sheish la'asot simcha mishten. Therefore, you can learn from this whole source about the cutting of the wood that the people who've learned Tanakh as a group, they should make a festive meal. V'neshevet mitzvah, and it's considered a sudat mitzvah kishe gomrim eiz sefer shlamdu b'iyun, when they complete a book of Tanakh that they learned in depth. However, aval pashut shura kishe lamdu kifi pirush emet. Moshe adds an addendum at the end, and this is kind of brought us back to a comment I made in the very beginning, which is that Rav Moshe is, when it comes to study of Tanakh, is fairly conservative in terms of the valid approaches to Tanakh and the standard traditional models learned Tanakh. And he makes this point that only you can make a siyum if you learn Tanakh appropriately, meaning you learned it with or through some type of classical, you know, medieval commentary or some other classical commentary, and not just from one of those people in the world that many of them are mistaken, they're not true, and many of them teach Torah against halacha. All of which, you know, as an addendum, I'll just make the comment, which is, you know, this is really Rav Moshe kind of being consistent in the yeshiva world. Tanakh is, you know, valued in a very specific, traditional manner. Rav Moshe certainly is part of that school of thought. And even the very comment of that Megillah Panim Batorah Shelo Kalacha, that you learn Torah against halacha, I mean, I'm just thinking of like my own learning Tanakh. Like most of Tanakh doesn't really cover halacha. It's not why you learn Tanakh. You learn Tanakh for its narrative value, for its moral value. You know, there are other reasons to learn Tanakh, not necessarily for its halachic value. And yet, Rav Moshe still feels the need to, you know, make that point because I think that's the worldview he's coming from, and he believes in. So, you know, I don't think modern Orthodox world we believe in the Tanakh part of it, but certainly in the Siyum aspect and the value in the Siyum, I think Rav Moshe's Tshuva is a really interesting and important. You know, work to think about.
Question.
Yeah.
It talks about you have to learn Tanakh Be'iyun to make a siyum on it. Now, people often make a siyum on Daf Yomi, Masechtos. Now, that's not Be'iyun, that's Bekiyus. So, nobody ever says you can't make a siyum on Daf Yomi learning, but, you know, people do it all the time.
Yeah.
And the same thing, the whole, at the end of the whole Shas, it's a siyum of Shas, but it's not Be'iyun. So why does it have to be Be'iyun for Tanakh? As you're saying, because normally, you know, make a siyum on Tanakh, so if you're going to make it on Tanakh, it has to be Be'iyun, whereas it doesn't have to be Be'iyun in Gemara? Or...
So my impression is it's just the question was being asked that way, just like the particulars of this question was a particular group was learning Tanakh, Be'iyun, you know, like, one particular, that's just the question. I don't think he would say, you know, even when it comes to Tanakh, let's say you finished like all of Tanakh, you know, and you finished it quickly, you did it, you know, very much remotely without like actually reading, you know, BE, and you just, you know, going BE if you want to finish all of Tanakh, which is itself, you know, a big accomplishment, or, you know, 900 plus program of Tanakh, it's very impressive. I think Rav Moshe would still say Shemei Kisiyum. I think it's just a question was talking about at Be'iyun. Really the focus, I think, is anything which is substantial, anything that, you know, you feel like you've completed something. And I think, to be honest, Rav Moshe probably would agree that there's some type of subjectivity to this. You know, just because, you know, if, depending on your learning ability, you know, different things are going to be more difficult than others. You know, if you, you know, you're Chaim Kanievsky and you've, you know, learned, you know, every Masechta a million times at this point, like you finish a Masechta, a Siyum might not be as significant as for someone who this is their first Masechta of Gemara. You know, so for the average Daf Yomi person, like a Masechta of Gemara is a big accomplishment. You know, even if it's a short, Masechta, it's only, you know, 30 Dafim. That's still a pretty significant accomplishment. 30 days straight of learning Gemara, you know, something should be celebrated. So I think Rav Moshe would agree with that. I don't think Iyun versus Bekiut is like a fundamental, you know, distinction he's making here. But that's my impression, at least. Yeah, I will say that it's funny you mention that, because in practice, people who learn Bekiut, people who learn, you know, broadly, you know, vast amounts of information instead of focusing on depth, tend to make a lot more siyums than people who learn in depth. It's just like the way it works, because since you're accomplishing, you're finishing, you know, very clear set goals, you make a siyum, you know, every time you finish a masechta, as opposed to those who don't, they don't really make so many siyums. And I actually remember hearing the story that Aaron Lichtenstein, the Tzal, when he was at YU, this is years and years ago, I heard that he taught Pesachim one year. The yeshiva was learning Pesachim, and Rav Lichtenstein taught Be'ion, he taught very slowly, it goes through very methodically, and they wouldn't cover so much ground, as opposed to other people who learned, covered a lot more ground. And so the first year, they finished the first parak of Pesachim. Pesachim has 10 parakim. Finished the first parak. The second year, they covered covered the second and part of the 10th parak. And then I think, I'm not sure, maybe I'm mistaking the story, but either there was a third year, or at the end of the second year, they made a siyum on Masechet Pesachim, and Rav Lichtenstein had a whole vort, oh, we cover the beginning and cover the end, that we get, like, you know, we get the Surat HaPetach, we get the, you know, the doorpost here, the doorpost there, that way we get the full thing of Pesachim, which obviously, you know, doesn't exactly work that way, but it's, but I think, you know, even for someone who does Iyun, it is valuable, you know, once in a while, to celebrate the accomplishment of what you've done, and I think that's true even if you do Iyun. It's worthwhile making siyums and celebrating and denoting, you know, the accomplishments you've had so far. So that's what I have to say about Tanit Bechorot. Any questions or comments so far? Okay, great. So I want to move on then to another tshuva Rav Moshe has, and I don't think we're going to finish it at all, but maybe we'll skip already straight now to kind of this middle section that Rav Moshe has, which is it's actually kind of like a side tangent Rav Moshe has, but it's really interesting. And we'll cover that today, and we'll cover the rest of the tshuva, I guess, next week. So this is the tshuva Rav Moshe writes. This is page 2. Rav Moshe writes his tshuva. Tshuva is written in Rosh Chodesh Iyar, Tavshin Aleph, so it's written right after Pesach, in 1981, right near the end of Rav Moshe's life. Rav Moshe is responding to a tshuva, to a question where Ephraim Greenblatt, one of his major talmidim in Memphis, asked him the following question. And the question is with regard to whether a woman can recite the Haggadah on behalf of a man. That's the question of Rav Moshe. And we're going to table the discussion about women's obligation in Haggadah. That's the discussion we'll talk about next week, because it's a little bit more involved, and I want to go through it next week. But I want to get to the third paragraph, the long paragraph in the middle, where Rav Moshe wants to differentiate and talk about, in the middle of this, the mitzvah of Haseba, the mitzvah of leaning. Right? So there's mitzvah on Pesach that we lean to our left, as a symbol of chayrut, the symbol of freedom, that we, you know, we're kings, we're royalty, we're able to, you know, drink comfortably. That's kind of the idea of a seba. And so the discussion the Rishonim have is, what about women? Are women obligated to lean back while they eat matzah, while they drink arba kosot? Are they obligated in doing so? And he says as follows. This is the Gemara, and you can actually see this, maybe see it clearer in the tour. It's actually on page 4. I want to turn to page 4. The tour, so the top of page 4, says as follows. I know the pages aren't numbered. I apologize for that. It's right before the Afikoman after Chatzot section. Right before that. So the tour says as follows. Isha Einef Tzricha Haseba. A woman is not required to lean. Why not? So So there are two explanations given. One explanation, because a woman has the fear of her husband. She has the not fear. Fear is like you're scared, but it's kind of the awe of her husband. She's respect of her husband, and therefore she doesn't lean back. This concept of it's kind of a, it's really an idea of respect, akin to the idea of if your Rebbe is with you at the meal, right? If you're a student and you have your Rosh Yeshiva or whatever it is with you at the meal, then you're not obligated to lean back either. A certain sign of respect, not to lean back, you know, while you're in presence of someone you're in awe of. And so the argument that Rosh Baal makes is that a woman does not need to lean back because she's in awe of her husband. And according to that, the Torah adds that according to that, Almano Grusha Bawaseba, if a woman is, you know, not married, a woman who is divorced or a widow, would be required to lean back, right? Because they wouldn't have a husband to be in awe of.
How about if she's not in awe of her husband?
Oh, we'll get there. Exactly. We're gonna get there. I promise you I'm not leaving the discussion here. We're gonna talk about this. I wanna just introduce this topic. Bahag is a second reason, another reason for why a woman is not obligated to lean back. Katav mishum de lav orach ara de isha lemizga, because it is not the way of the world for a woman to lean back. It's not a way of a woman to drink a lot of wine. It's just not. It's not the proper. It's not the way that women typically operate. Therefore the fizeh kol isha enes tichasiba. According to that, it wouldn't make a difference whether you're married or not, whether you're single, married, divorced, widowed. Any woman would not be obligated in a seba, in leaning back. The language of the Torah here, by the way, is just the language of not required, which implies that the woman would be allowed to if you wanted to. Other Rishonim have other languages that they're not allowed to. There's a lot of discussion about it. There is one exception. The Gemara mentioned this last thing in Torah, that an Isha, even back then, an Isha Chashuva, if you're an important woman, if you're it's hard to define what important woman means, but an important woman, you are obligated to lean back. A important woman is obligated to lean back. That's all the Rishonim. That's the Psak and Halacha with regard to
leaning back. Would have been obligated to
leave. Yeah, exactly. But Rav Moshe has this really interesting analysis, actually, about all of these terms. What does this mean, a woman can't lean back because of Eimat Bala? What does it mean that Isha Chashuva? Because the traditional manner, and I want to really phrase it this way because I want to explain how significant Rav Moshe's suggestion is. The traditional manner of understanding it is it's really, you know, it's based on older sociological terms. A woman, just their place in society was, you know, beneath their husband or beholden to their husband in a very different manner. Maybe they weren't even as intelligent or as educated as their husbands, just the way education often worked back then. And so that's kind of the reason why they wouldn't lean back. Women's place, you know, I don't have to expound on the woman's place in the world, in the traditional world, you know, we all know what it was. And for that reason, they wouldn't lean back. And Isha Chashuva was kind of the exception, you know, some very wealthy, you know, woman or very important woman. They were the exception. But for the most part, women really did not have to lean back. That's kind of the background of the sugya. But Rav Moshe makes, and this is really an aside, and I'll show you how it's an aside, makes this really, really interesting suggestion. So I'm just going to read the beginning of that paragraph. So it does as follows. He's talking about the general obligations of women on Seder night. And he says, this is the main paragraph on page 2, the big one. Lo dami da'ad kot la'aseba, nisha chashuva tzricha aseba. He says, first, when it comes to leaning back, aseba, in general, women have an obligation. And he proves this because A, an important woman, Isha Chashuva, has an obligation. And he says, even for women who are not important women, we still have to come up with reasons to explain why they didn't have to lean back. And then Rav Moshe understands by some reading the Rishonim that there seems to be this contention that we have to explain why they're not obligated, because the default would have been they are obligated. So he thinks default really should be obligated, but we have to have, you know, some type of explanation for why they're not obligated. And he quotes the two opinions we just quoted now in the tour. Itab Rashbam, Shneib Tamim, there are two reasons for why a woman is not obligated to be back. Tam Rishim, they aim at Baal the Kufalo. Reason one, because of the awe she has for her husband. Vitam Shani, Mishil to Darv Achai, Lav Darkai, the Nashil Mizga, because it's not the way of women to generally drink wine. Vika Chilakadina, he quotes that there's a nafkamina, it's going to be a halachic distinction between these. One distinction was already quoted in the tour we saw, the Pligib Isha Almano Grusha. One distinction is going to be between these two reasons, right? Reason one, awe of your husband. Reason two, because it's not the way of a woman to drink wine. Reason one is going to be if you're not married, right? That's going to be a distinction. And distinction two, or most going to quote now, Yehu bebaal she'enu makpid. What if your husband, right, is not particularly makpid? He's not, he doesn't care if you lean back, right? So if a husband doesn't care, you lean back, then maybe you're not really in awe of him in the same way, and therefore you should be able to lean back. According to the base, the first reason, based on the awe of your husband, you'd be able to lean back. Based on, and this is quoted actually in the Chelket Yaakov, but according to the second reason, the reason of women generally do not drink wine, you would still not be obligated to lean back, because, you know, the way of women to drink wine is not going to change whether or not you have a husband who cares or not. That's the comment. Ubeit Yosef Ita, there's another, a third opinion that's quoted. Beit Yosef makes the following comment, and this is actually the traditional psakin for most Ashkenazim, that women are considered to be chashuvot, that our women are considered, all of them, to be important women. That's the opinion we do, and that's actually the psak we tend to paskin like, that most women really should lean back if they can. They don't have to if they don't want to necessarily. There's, you know, ways to avoid it, but they really should if they can. That's all Rav Moshe's point, and the rest of it really not relevant to our purpose. But then you can see that there's the parentheses. And Rav Moshe's parentheses, you know, it's really a side point, but it's a really, really interesting one. Because Rav Moshe makes the following point. It asks the following, and it's really, you know, it's really an aside, but it's really, really important. This is the following. So the Bach asked the following question for the Rashbam, right? The Rashbam had given an explanation. Why is it that a woman is obligated to lean back? So Rashbam had, why a woman is not obligated or is not allowed to lean back. So Rashbam had said, because mitam eimat bala, because she has the awe of her husband. And so the Bach asked, right, so Circus asked a question about on this issue. Shehare gam isha chashuva tzarishite alea eimat bala. Bach asked, if so, how come an important woman, right, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, so Ruth Bader Ginsburg was married. And if so, why, even though she was an important woman, she too should have had the awe of her husband, regardless of her, you know, stature in society. She still should have had, you know, a certain, you know, awe of her husband based on the familial, you know, structures. And therefore, even an important woman should not be obligated to lean back, just like any other woman. And so the Bach asks, how come, you know, an important woman was allowed to lean back, based on this reasoning? So that's the Bach's comment. And the Rosh Moshe says as follows. V'lo muvan kushyatel. I don't understand this question at all. V'chihu mitzvah u'retzon ha'chamim sh'tei eimat ba'ala b'dvarim ba'alma she'inu gelo. Is there some type of commandment that the Torah obligates us, or that the rabbis obligate us, that a woman has to have the fear of her husband, or that a husband has to impose his awe upon his wife? Right? That's some type of obligation. Especially in a situation in which his awe is going to prevent her from doing a mitzvah. Is that some type of, like, you know, metaphysical or halachic obligation? Of course not. That's not a halachic obligation. It might have been a sociological reality at a particular time, but it's not an obligation. And the emotion says, additionally, not only is it not a, you know, a metaphysical, you know, ontological obligation, but it's also, it's not even something that's good necessarily on behalf of the husband, right? It's not necessarily a good statement about, what does it say about a husband who, you know, prevents his wife from being able to lean back, right? It's not necessarily a good statement because you see that for hundreds of years, you know, people were not machbid about it, that women were allowed to lean back, some type of evidence to the fact that, you know, there's clearly value that women should be able to lean back and shouldn't have the awe of their husband. And he quotes that sheet, the opinion we just quoted from Tosfot, Shekola Nashim Chashuvot Heimetz Yichod Aseba. The Gemara Mordechai Vikain, this value of every woman being able to lean back is truly a value that's been practiced for hundreds of years. And so how can you possibly suggest that there is this, you know, this supererogatory other value of a husband imposing his awe upon his wife? Right, that doesn't really make sense. There's no proof to that. This is some type of halachic value. And he says as follows. This is a really, really interesting point. V'lo shayach lefareish, shekol ha'nashim nasu chashuvot mamash. He says, typically, the way that it's explained is that back then, right? Women were just less educated. Sociologically, they had a lower role in the house. And that's why they didn't lean back. Nowadays, women are more important. Women are able to leave the home. Women have jobs. They can be very important careers. They can be judges, you know, Supreme Court. They can do all sorts of things. And they're educated. And that's why they are chashuvot. That's why they're obligated, because they're not like the women back then. Back then, they were illiterate. Now they are literate. Now they are knowledgeable. And therefore, they should be able to lean back. That's the traditional explanation for why a woman nowadays is able to, or has an obligation to lean back. Rav Moshe says that's not what's happening here. It's not even true. He's not necessarily disregarding the facts of the change sociologically, but that's not why a woman nowadays is obligated to lean back. This is the online part. The underlined part. It's not because all of a sudden women became more literate. It's rather because men began to realize that there's no value to be proud of being, you know, more important than your wife. It became more apparent. Men over history began to learn that you don't need to have this type of, you know, strict, you know, hierarchical, you know, system in a household, and that a married couple can live very well, even as equal partners. You don't need to have this, you know, this strict awe of your husband. And women began to see that husbands began to value them more, more than just, you know, domestic help, but really be able to value them as people. And that's really the sociological change that's happened, and it's significant for our purposes. It's not so much that women are more literate, but rather that their value in society has increased. It may have come to, concurrently with, you know, more education, but it's more just a significant of the sociological changes of how we perceive women in our marriages in general. And he says as follows: even the women who are chashuvot, right, the important women back then, right? So Alan had quoted Ruth Bader Ginsburg, right, an important woman. And that is the traditional explanation. An important woman refers to someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, someone who had held important societal positions, right, the real exceptions. But Rav Moshe says that's actually not what Nashim Chashuvot means in this context. Nashim Chashuvot means a woman for whom her husband recognized her value. That's what Nashim Chashuvot means. And so even back then, when you talk about an important woman, it actually wasn't based on her societal value, based on her societal status, but really based upon the nature of the relationship she had in her marriage. If she had, you know, a marriage where the couple was more on equal footing, where the, you know, they each valued each other as equal partners, then the woman was obligated to lean back, and she was defined as an Isha Chashuva. That's what Isha Chashuva means. These women, they recognize that they need their husbands, like they want their husbands, and they recognize that equally, in equal measure, that their husbands needed them. They were equal partners in that, and that's what Isha Chashuva means. And so that's really the part we're going to focus on today. I'm going to end here, but I think that Rav Moshe makes this really, really interesting argument about Nashim Chashuvot, what it means societally, what does it mean on a sociological level, really distinct from the traditional meaning of Nashim Chashuvot. And I think it's just a really interesting point, and we'll talk about it. We haven't really covered so many Rav Moshe's chuvos about women, you know, ability to perform mitzvot and things of the sort. But I think at least in this argument, Rav Moshe makes an argument, you know, that certainly feels, if anything, you know, much more palatable to our modern way of thinking. We certainly, I personally think that I relate a lot more to this type of answer, and I think it's a really novel way of approaching the sugya. I actually have never seen anyone else quoted this way, and I think it's just really interesting and worth sharing as Rav Moshe kind of reanalyzes sugya in this way.
Okay, does anybody else hold like this?
In terms of like the psak of leaning, yeah, plenty of people do. I mean, the standard Ashkenazi psak based on the Ravya is that in fact women should probably lean back. But I've actually never seen this type of explanation. And it's really a reworking of the sugya. Isha Chashuva, that term of like an important woman, it usually does not mean this. I'll give you an example where it comes up. There's like a parallel reverse situation. What if Martin Kedushin talks about different ways of getting married, of process of Kedushin. And the traditional method of Kedushin is a man gives a woman some type of gift, and through that present, the woman is married. The Gemara talks about what if it's an ish, what if the woman gives him the present? So typically, the problem is that you need the woman to have hana. You need the woman to receive a crucial type of benefit from this transaction, from this action of giving, you know, a present of sorts. And so typically when you give a present, you don't really get the same type of pleasure as on receiving a present, some type of, you know, actual benefit accrued. But the Gemara states, what if you give a present, the woman gives a present to what's called an ish chashuv, an important person, right, an important man. Because giving a gift, you know, to the queen or, you know, or to the king, that's such an important, and the king accepting the gift, right, that's such a, you know, I get a lot of pleasure out of like giving a gift to someone so important. And so the Gemara suggests, Gemara quotes, and it's actually halacha, that if a woman gives a gift to a really important man, such that she receives accrues benefit from his acceptance of the gift, then she can be married through that action as well. And in that context, ish chashuv, this idea of this important man, I've never seen anyone else quote it, that it's someone who's valued equal partners. Ish chashuv there means like his societal status is an important status, right? The same way that Isha Chashuva is traditionally understood. And so I don't think Rav Moshe reinterprets that Gemara either. I don't think he's going to reinterpret that case. But it is rather a unique approach that he makes here. But I, as I said, I really think it's more palatable, and it's a lot less apologetic, I think, than the, you know, the traditional approach of, oh, sociologically we changed. I think it's really a statement of, you know, really it's almost on the men, on the husbands who didn't recognize their wives sufficiently back in the day. And nowadays that we have, you know, thank God, more equal marriages where both parties are acknowledged and valued as equal partners, that's what Nashim Chashivot means, and they are valuable and able and should lean back for that reason. Any other comments? Otherwise, I guess we'll stop here today, and we will continue with this, I guess, next week.